My phone is, of course, set to receive weather warnings from numerous places in the U.S. Southwest, places like Kayenta, Flagstaff, Springdale, Zion, places like that. And my phone kept going off. I looked down to take a look at what was sort of distracting me, and I realized that what was going on is I kept getting all of these weather updates. Keep my phone ready in case when I'm traveling down there I need to get a weather update. The rest of the year it's just out of general interest. But I kept getting all these weather updates from everywhere across the U.S. Southwest, and they all said the exact same thing. Flash flood warning. At the time, I paid them little attention because, of course, I wasn't in the area, but I would learn the next day that tragedy had struck, as it always does in this area during the summer. See, summer temperatures in Arizona can exceed 40 degrees Celsius. I mean, it is bloody hot down there. And so on July 15th of this year, a family of 14 had set out from Phoenix to celebrate a birthday and escape the heat by visiting a little water hole called Cold Springs in Tonto National Park. Family of 14 ranged in age from 5 to 65 years old, and they had no idea the danger they had just put themselves in. Flash flooding is, of course, incredibly common across the mountains and the desert of the U.S. Southwest, especially during the summer monsoon season. Rains come on so fast and furious that the parched and dry soil of the U.S. Southwest, it simply can't absorb it all in such a short amount of time. And so when this happens, water accumulates in these dry stream beds and it turns into monster floods as they descend upon the narrow canyons that are everywhere in this area. And 10 out of the 14 family members would die that day. The four survivors would be picked up clutching to trees later on. And the story they told was horrific. As they recounted, they were simply relaxing around this waterhole when all of a sudden they felt this cold breeze rush through the canyon. And then they heard this loud roar, like a thunder jet. And as they turned to see the commotion up the canyon, they saw rushing toward them a massive wall of dark, muddy water, carrying tree trunks, logs, boulders the size of small cars. The wall of water that this particular flash flood produced when it hit was measured at 6 feet high and 40 feet wide. It's terrifying to think about. And in just a few seconds, three generations of family were swept away in torrents of murky, muddy water. And the unfortunate part of this story is that it happens every year, this exact same thing. When I heard about the story, I immediately looked up one of my favorite authors and writers, Craig Childs. He's an amazing writer on the U.S. Southwest. He's a flash flood expert. I looked up to see what he was saying, and you could almost hear the resignation in his voice as he pleaded on Facebook. His post was, "I've spent my whole life, my whole career," he said, "warning people about the dangers of canyons during monsoon season. You can't simply assume that because it's sunny where you are, that you're not in danger. Because what flash floods do are this, a storm miles away can drop water, and then it starts rushing. It can be sunny where you are and hit you, and you would have no clue." And so he ended his post with, "Be prepared. Check the weather all around you." You know, floods are terrifying. This keeps going out. Floods are terrifying. We know that. They can destroy lives and landscapes with like this intense ferocity. And it's weird because, right, we don't live in an area that's prone to dangerous flooding, but it doesn't occupy our minds a whole lot. Like this past spring, we had the Grand River flood, you know, a couple of feet. That was a big deal. I drove down to the river to see it because it's such a rare occurrence for us to get any sort of flooding. But even though we're not in an area prone to dangerous flooding, we have watched over the past 10, 20 years as floods have wreaked havoc across the world. I mean, the flooding alone that was caused in the 2006 tsunami in Asia, it took the lives of 280,000 people. And so I think you could say this, that the danger of flooding waters is seared into the collective human imagination. And so because of that, it's no wonder to me that there are tales, flood tales, that permeate every culture across all of time. Mercy Iliad, in his book, The History of Religious Ideas, he notes that the flood mythology motif is recorded in every culture on every continent. It's found in Greek mythology, Hinduism, Chinese mythology, Norse mythology, in the lore of the K'iche' and Maya peoples in Mesoamerica, the tribes of Native Americans in North America, the Musca and the Canary Confederation in South America, Aboriginal tribes even in Australia. Tales of a massive, catastrophic flood are found everywhere in history. And of course, perhaps the most popular of them all is the story of Noah and his ark in Genesis 6 to 8. And you know, it's hard to come at this story with fresh eyes, right? I've come to think that the most familiar parts of the Bible are often the parts we have the hardest time looking at. They're too familiar. I mean, if you grew up in church, this story is the stuff of Sunday school flannel graph legend, right? I mean, it's just a perfect story. A boat, animals two by two, rainbows. Later on in life, right, it became a bit of a debate. How old is the earth? Was this a global flood, a local flood? Were dinosaurs on the boat? You know, all these sort of questions. And then a little bit more sophisticated, but later on in life, this story caused many people to go, well, this God character, huh, I don't know, destroying the whole world? And yet for me, all of these discussions have, in many ways, become an exercise in missing the point. And so if we can, what I want to ask us this morning is this, could we try for the next few minutes to leave our modern lenses behind? And I think we need to do that for four important reasons. The first is this. Israel's neighbors told flood stories that were very, very similar to Israel's story. In fact, the Sumerian story, the Epic of Gilgamesh, it's eerily similar to the Genesis tale. The rabbinic scholar Robert Wexler says this, the most likely assumption we can make is that both Genesis and Gilgamesh drew their material from a common tradition about a flood that existed in Mesopotamia. These stories then diverged in the retelling. Second, the Genesis story was written after these stories. Same way when we talked about Genesis 1, the Enuma Elish was written first. It's the same here. In the ancient material in that area, you've got the Sumerian version of the flood story, then you've got the Assyrian version, then you've got the Babylonian version, then the Genesis version shows up. They all talk about a flood, but the reasons for why the flood happened are very different. Third, and this might be the hardest for us to get our heads around, in the ancient Near Eastern time, everything was attributed to God. Everything. Things that you and I might chalk up to normal weather patterns, that was the gods. And so there was never any question in anyone's mind, does God cause natural disasters? We would debate about that today. In the ancient Near East, we'd be like, of course, they cause everything to happen. And so, for instance, in the Babylon version of the flood story, the question is why? Why did the gods cause the flood? And I'm not kidding about this. It's kind of funny, actually. For the Babylonians, the reason the gods caused the flood is because humans were too noisy and the gods couldn't sleep. And so, in their version of the story, it's like, boom, flood, that should shut you up for a while. They couldn't get enough sleep, so they caused the flood. It's like, seems a little sinister. And, you know, this whole idea that the gods cause everything, it might sound a little primitive to us, but if you think about it, the pattern of logic is not that different than the way we think about weather patterns today. I mean, it's the same pattern of logic. So today, we would say, there's bad weather, my crops aren't working. The forces of nature must not be happy. Why? Well, because we probably did something wrong like climate change. Now we need to fix it. And it's a very similar pattern of logic back then. The weather's not working well. Why? Well, the gods are angry. We must have done something. Now we need to fix it. It's a similar pattern of logic. And so they attribute everything to the gods. The gods did everything. And fourth, I'd say this. These flood stories are written not only as an explanation of what happened, but what happens. They're an explanation for what happens all the time. They're archetypal. In fact, I think all of Genesis 1 to 11 is archetypal. And so these stories, you could say, are sort of distilled reality. They're hyper-reality. And so I'll say it again. I've said it before in this series. These stories contain patterns about the human condition that are always true. And what that means is that there's something about your life and my life that's echoed in this story. These stories are describing what's common across all human experience across all time. They're archetypal. And so what we know coming into the story is this. There's some kind of massive, memorable flood that occurs in the ancient world, and people across the world tell stories about it. Not about what happened. Everyone knows what happened. There was a flood. They start trying to tell stories about why it happened and what that says about us as humans. And so it's kind of similar to journalism. In the ancient Near East, it was like, this event happened, and now I'm going to use that as a platform to talk about why. And we've seen this in the news a lot lately. An event happens, and then we have people tell stories about why that happened. Think even just gun control. And so as we jump into the story, I'm going to confess something right away. Genesis 6, 1 to 4, I don't have a clue what's going on there. If you look it up, it's a story about Nephilim and giants and angels having sex with women, and apparently that doesn't make God happy. And I'm checking like the best commentaries, and I still don't have a clue what's going on there. It's very, very confusing. Whatever Nephilim is, if you watch the Noah movie that came out, they're depicted as these giant creatures, and I'm like, I don't know. So, I don't know. I'm going to skip that part. Let's jump in. Verse 5. The Lord saw how great the wickedness of the human race had become on the earth, and that every inclination of the thoughts of the human heart was only evil all the time. The Lord regretted that he had made human beings on the earth, and his heart was deeply troubled. So the Lord said, I will wipe from the face of the earth the human race I have created, and with them the animals, the birds, and the creatures that move along the ground, for I regret that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. Now, whoa. Where to start there? I mean, this is quite an indictment on humans. And you know, one of the things that I think really tires people out about church is the consistent, constant, endless harping about sinful nature. Most people, I think, feel bad enough about themselves entering a Sunday morning gathering that we become weary when we show up to church and hear people say, you're totally depraved. It's like, oh, I already feel bad enough about myself. Thanks for telling me that I'm incredibly evil. I mean, in some ways, it's kind of bizarre. Church can often seem like a self-flagellating community. We get together to whip ourselves. It's almost like in some churches, people love to go to church to hear how bad they are. Tell me again, preacher. Tell me how bad I am. It's weird. And so it's wearisome to many people. And so I'm left going, what exactly do you do with this story that at least hints that the human heart is questionable? Well, I do think there's some real value in stories like this, prompting us to keep the evil things we do conscious in our minds. And to me, this story prompts so many questions. And the thing is this, I don't think it needs to be self-flagellating. The focus on sin in Scripture is not some sort of antiquated notion. I mean, I think we can think about like this. Each of us can hear this story, the beginning of it, as a warning that it would describe like this. Look out, because there's a bunch of ways that you are not being everything you could be. And if you address those things, your life would be better, and everyone else's life would be better. So look out and look inside yourself. I mean, it's kind of like this. Look inside yourself, Brad. How well do you know yourself? Do you know what you're doing? And that's a question worth asking. Just exactly what are my motives in life? Because here's the thing. Whenever I ask myself that question, I get really tied up inside. And it's possible, I suppose, that all of you are just much more noble than I am. But whenever I sort of try to answer that question, rarely do I find that my motives in most of life are entirely pure. And so it's worth considering, or think about it this way, how much trouble are you trying to cause in life? Conscious or not? And you go, what do you mean, trouble? Well, trouble's more interesting than boring. And Storytelling 101 would say this, the worst thing about a story is it for to be boring. We need conflict and we need trouble. And so part of me can't help but wonder, how often in life do we create trouble and conflict? How well do we know ourselves? What exactly are my motives? What's going on inside my heart? And you know, maybe it's this. Maybe only 10% of you has questionable motives. And part of me thinks that doesn't matter, because coming to terms with that would be a good thing, because then you can do something about it. And what would be the downside to that? And so we come to this passage, it's like, make what you will of the indictment of the human heart, but at the very least, allow it to prompt some introspection. Because here's the thing that the authors of Genesis knew that we need to know as well. It's this: human beings are the only creatures in the entire universe who are capable of conscious deceit and malevolence. And the question is, to what degree does that exist in you, in me? So the story starts, it sort of prompts us with this archetypal call to reflection, because humans are capable of some pretty nasty stuff. And so you better do some soul searching, because none of us are exempt from that. I've been thinking about that a lot this week with the phenomenon we're seeing right now, the Me Too hashtag, that women are telling their stories online about ways they've faced sexual harassment, and the complete collapse we are seeing of so many powerful men in Hollywood. I mean, it's just unbelievable what's being exposed. And you know, anytime we see evil or malevolence of some kind, I think it's a perfect time. It should spawn not only anger on our parts, but self-reflection. You know, we have to unravel a culture that produces males who somehow think they can take advantage of women with impunity. We have to engage in some self-reflection. All of us do. And you can say, well, I've never done anything wrong like that. Yeah, but we're part of a culture, a system that produces that. And I think for all of us, it's going, well, maybe it's time to really look inside, do some soul searching. Carries on. Noah somehow catches the attention of God. It says, Noah was a righteous man, blameless among the people of his time, and he walked faithfully with God. And he had three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now the earth was corrupt in God's sight and was full of violence. God saw how corrupt the earth had become, for all the people on the earth had corrupted their ways. So God said to Noah, I'm going to put an end to all people, for the earth is filled with violence. I'm surely going to destroy both them and the earth. So make yourself an ark of cypress wood. And so you have a few verses there, and then the next two chapters are essentially detailed instructions for Noah about making the ark and bringing in the animals. And they get all of that done, and then the flood comes, and it lasts for 150 days, and they ride out the storm. And there's a whole lot worth considering here. Because if you can, even for a moment, allow yourself the freedom to see this story as archetypal, as a story that's more than just an explanation of what happened somewhere in the distant world, but as an explanation for what still happens, there's a frightening warning here, and it's this: the flood is coming. It's coming. Because there's going to be situations in your life when you're going to face a flood. Chaos will be unleashed in your life. It's going to happen to you, and it's going to happen to me. The flood is coming for all of us. And when it does, you're going to want to know how to build an ark to get through it, so to speak. How do you manage that? How do you manage a catastrophe in life so that you have a fighting chance of moving through it and picking up the pieces after? You know, it's interesting. So the story says, God's not happy. He's going to wipe everything out. And it's like, okay. You can call that what you want. You could call it life. You could call it the universe. You could call it fate. You can call it God. But what the story seems to suggest is this. There are going to be times when your life is going to get completely washed out. And when the story that there was one man who had a way of living and being that somehow protected him from that, well, part of me thinks that might also be something to pay attention to. The story pushes us in a very real and practical sense. There are floods coming, and there is a way to ride it out, but it's rare. And so for me, the story is a bit of a wake-up call. Let's not fool ourselves. The flood is coming. In all likelihood, you're going to be afflicted with a serious illness at least once in your life. Maybe more. And it could be chronic. And if it isn't you, it's going to be someone you love. That is going to happen. It could be your husband, your parent, your child, your friend. It is coming. That's a certainty. And you know, perhaps here at Nexus, we're on average a little bit younger than perhaps some other churches, but the reality is this, the flood is on the horizon. It is coming. There is death and pain on the horizon. And the question becomes this, exactly what kind of person are you going to be when the flood comes? The story I think of Noah and the ark is really about is this, the floods are always coming. So what do? You prepare. That's what you do. You know, we can argue and debate all we want. Life isn't fair. God isn't fair. And you're right. It isn't. Life is not fair. And God doesn't always appear to be the domesticated God we wish God was. But I don't think it's any accident that if you read through Genesis 6 to 8, the story spends way more time talking about the logistics of building the ark than it does addressing any theological problems or questions we have with the story. I mean, the verses are, and then he got this piece of wood and put this together. It's like details, planning. It's like, so now what? Life isn't fair. God doesn't seem to be fair. So now what? Well, you prepare. That's the point. I mean, consider this, if you will, through a different lens, hurricanes. Consider Hurricane Katrina in 2005. It was a powerful and destructive storm that completely leveled New Orleans, right? We don't even have to look that far. Hurricane Harvey this year, which drastically flooded parts of Texas, particularly Houston. And then again, Hurricane Irma, which leveled parts of the Caribbean and parts of Florida. I mean, these storms flooded and leveled everything in their path. And you know, there's a part of me, you can look at that, there's sort of two ways to look at that. The first is this, well, I guess Mother Nature had a temper tantrum and sends hurricanes occasionally to wipe everything out. You think, well, what can we possibly do about that? I mean, we're so fragile compared to the power of nature. But there's another way of reading it, and I don't want to be too judgmental, but it works for the point of illustration. Consider the Dutch. Netherlands is a country, a large part of the country is supposed to be underwater. But currently, it's not. Why? Well, they build dikes and dams and levees to keep the ocean back. And to this point, they seem to be doing a really good job of it. And I think there's a reason for that. I was researching this week their techniques for building dikes and levees. And they have a rule when they build and plan, and it's fascinating to me. They try to estimate what is the worst possible oceanic storm that could hit us within the next 10,000 years. And then we're going to build our dikes and dams and levees to withstand that. And if you look at what the Dutch are in the midst of doing right now, it's even more spectacular. With climate change threatening to raise sea levels even higher, the Dutch are in the midst of extending their most vulnerable shorelines 3 to 4 miles out. Like, this is trouble. We're going to extend our shorelines out 3 to 4 miles. Coastal engineer Marcel Stive says this about their current projects. If you see a certain future, you must react. And for the Dutch, the future looks wet, very wet. So what do? You prepare. In fact, in the past few years, the Dutch have assembled what they call the Delta Committee. And the task of this committee is to take it even further. I find it fascinating. They're tasked with this: ensuring that their country is not only prepared for a 1 in 10,000 year storm, but to move it towards becoming prepared for a 1 in 100,000 year storm. And to do that, you're spending $1.5 billion over the next 100 years. They have a 100-year plan. That's mind-boggling to me. I mean, even municipality here, we're thinking, maybe in 10 years we'll have a GO train to Toronto, right? It's like, maybe. They're planning out 100 years. And why? If you see a certain future, you must react. Now consider what's happened along the Gulf Coast of the United States, places like New Orleans and Houston and Florida. Here's what I've learned. When the Army Corps of Engineers were tasked with protecting areas like New Orleans for floods, they built the system to manage the worst storm they could imagine happening in the span of 100 years. Now think about that. That's not good. Because humans tend to live to about 80 years, which means what? The possibility of one of these storms coming and happening in a lifespan is very high. And so perhaps this wasn't the wisest of planning. And so it's not like the planners didn't know a storm of the magnitude of Katrina or Harvey or Irma was possible. In fact, it's the exact opposite. They did know it was possible. In fact, both New Orleans and Houston knew these storms were coming and did little or nothing to fix it. So what do you call that? Is Hurricane Katrina an act of God? A natural disaster? Or is that a very human problem? And this is where the mythological stories here, they line up so well with our own. I mean, you can tell a story about Mother Nature or God manufacturing catastrophe and how that's unfair. Or you could tell a different story about the absolute failure of the human social structure to address problems everyone knows exists. Whose fault is it when you know the storm is coming and you do nothing about it? And so think about it this way. How big a hurricane would it take to wipe out New Orleans if everyone was prepared? I mean, everyone. Every individual, municipality, state, federal government, all levels are on it. How big a storm would you need? Because we know how to do it. We know how to plan. With that kind of planning that the Dutch have, you're going to need a big storm to wipe out the Dutch. I think the same applies in our own lives. There are floods coming. You can be sure of that. It's 100% certain. And some of them are going to be personal. Some of them are going to be familial. Some will be financial, others might be social or political. But as the Dutch would say, if you see a certain future, you must react. So how do you ride them out? How do you prepare? Well, in some cases, it could be as simple as not going where you know the flood's going to be, right? Don't put yourself in the canyon when there's a flash flood warning. Could be as simple as that. But for many of us, we won't have that luxury. We won't have a choice. We will simply, in our lives, face catastrophe. It's unavoidable. And you know, maybe when that happens, there's like just a tiny pathway through that where everything doesn't fall apart. Maybe there's but a slim chance that your catastrophe in life doesn't end in divorce, your family fighting, or in a community like this, that the whole thing falls apart. Maybe there's like a slim chance. The margin of error between surviving and everything falling apart could be slim to virtually none. And the reality is this: every single imperfection that you or I bring to the situation is only going to magnify it. That's coming. Absolutely. And so if you see a certain future, you must react. And how? Well, could start by building an ark with the hopes of riding it out. And the best thing we can do as humans is to put ourselves together so that when the flood comes, maybe, just maybe, if we've developed ourselves well enough, we might be able to rise above it. But here's the thing, there's a big gulf between our lives and the archetypal story. In fact, it can almost sound cheesy. How am I supposed to build an ark with my life, right? How do you do that? How do you build a way of life that sort of puts us in the position of Noah, ready to ride out the storms? How is that practical or personal at all? Well, Scripture to me is fascinating because it's so hyperlinked everywhere. And Jesus' words in Matthew are really catching my attention lately, especially his last lines in the Sermon on the Mount. So when we catch up with Jesus here, he's just spent most of three chapters giving very practical instructions about how to live. And then he closes his Sermon on the Mount with this. It says, "Therefore, everyone who hears these words of mine and puts them into practice is like a wise man who built his house on the rock. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, yet it did not fall, because it had its foundations on the rock. But everyone who hears these words of mine and does not put them into practice is like a foolish man who built his house on sand. The rain came down, the streams rose, and the winds blew and beat against that house, and it fell with a great crash." And when Jesus had finished saying these things, the crowds were amazed at his teaching, because he taught as one who had authority and not as their teachers of the law. Jesus, up to this point, has just provided the way. The storm is coming. How are you going to deal with that? As he gives this body of teaching, he says, you follow this, and maybe, just maybe, you'll be able to ride out the storms, the floods, when they come. And so this whole year I've been planning that we'd go to Genesis and then we'd get spit out of Genesis and do like a sub-series, and we'd just jump back into Genesis this week and barely 1 week into it, and I think it's spitting us back out already and saying, you know what, there's something to explore here. And so what I want to do is take the next 2 weeks and detour out of Genesis about to talk about what Jesus is saying here. How do we put Jesus' wisdom into practice? If we're going to build an ark, we're going to need tools, a foundation. And that's where I want to head the following 2 Sundays. So I'm going to ask the band to come as we reflect on the story, and there's so much more to Noah's story. We'll get to that sometime. But say for this, for now, in a nutshell, I think this is where the story of Noah and the ark pushes us. It pushes us to a scary truth and an uncomfortable question. And the scary truth is this: the flood is coming. Life is difficult. Life is not fair. And that sucks. Because the flood is always coming. It is. That is a certainty. So then the question becomes this: exactly what kind of person are we going to be when the flood shows up?